This is On Being's Unheard Cuts. I'm Krista Tippett. You're listening to my extended conversation with Paulo Coelho. He's the author of many books, including the bestseller, The Alchemist. I spoke with him on July 1st, 2014, from Calliopeia Studio at On Being on Loring Park. He was at Hastings Audio Network, a private recording studio in Geneva, Switzerland. Honoring our guest's request, we've excised a few minutes of this interview. You can download the MP3 of our produced show with Paulo Coelho at onbeing.org. Hello, this is Krista Tippett.
Hello, Krista.
Yes.
This is Paulo. How are you?
I'm good. It's lovely to have you on the other end.
It is my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, I'm just thrilled. I want to hear how you say your name so that I say it correctly.
Coelho, but don't worry about it. Nobody says it correctly.
Okay. Huh? Well, I'm going to worry about it a little bit. I'll do my best.
Probably if you call me Paulo, it's easy for you, no?
All right. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for making the time for this.
My honor. My honor.
Yeah. Chris, how are we doing for, do we need to, let me ask you just for production sake, let me ask you some mundane question like what you had for lunch.
You're talking to me, right?
Yes.
So I never have lunch because I think we can eat only twice a day. So I have a good breakfast. And I have dinner. What did I have for breakfast? I had bread and olive oil and yogurt that here they call yaourt in French. It's very complicated. I never get used to this strange word, yaourt. Then I had prunes and I had black coffee.
Sounds good. How long?
And you?
I have started having quinoa for breakfast every morning. So I have
good.
I have quinoa and almond butter and blueberries for breakfast. I recommend
okay.
it. say, how long have you lived in Geneva? I'm just curious.
For this past, I was here. I moved. I had the residence in 2006, but I moved on 2009.
Huh.
And have you been to Geneva before?
A long time ago. Yes, not for a while. I know it's beautiful.
Uh-huh. It is beautiful because it is a village. And like any village, you have the countryside. The technician is laughing because she knows what I'm talking about. So we don't have any stress here. You have cows, like in the postcards that you see from Switzerland. And then you have chocolate. And then you have, the Alps, the mountains.
Yeah.
You should
not have told us that you live in a place where there's no stress, because when people hear this interview, they'll start moving there in droves.
Don't do that.
Okay.
No. But they have also very strict legislation here.
Okay.
They don't allow.
All right. That's good.
They have a very strict legislation. Geneva can't go beyond 143,000 people.
Uh-huh.
And if you can move to Switzerland, but then you have to move to another, what they call canton, to another place, and also be very happy and live a not very stressful life here.
Okay.
I was watching you on TED.
Oh.
Beautiful, beautiful talk about compassion and tolerance.
Well, thank you so much. That means a lot to me. Well, thank you. Yeah. Where I'd like to start is you've written quite a lot about the religious background of your childhood as having many aspects of being punishing and joyless. But I wonder if you think about the spiritual background of your childhood, perhaps a spiritual sensibility that was forming in you even then, even if you didn't know it. How would you think about that?
Well, I didn't know very well because I was forced.
Yeah.
To believe in God, I was forced to pray. I was in a Jesuit school.
Yeah.
And so it was very difficult for me to accept God and spirituality, because when you try to force someone to do this, it's not the best way to open the doors of this unknown world to someone. So, but at the end of the day, the Jesuit, they taught me something very important, that it is discipline. And then by discipline, of course, I went through a period that I denied everything that I learned, because for the reasons that I told you.
Yeah.
But then when I returned and I was already 40 years old, it was after my pilgrimage to Santiago de Compostela, then it was fantastic because it was a choice, not something that it was imposed to me.
Right, right. And that's so much more a story of our time, I think, people choosing their spiritual and religious lives rather than merely inheriting them in their families, which happened for so many centuries, really.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Because for a period, for example, during the hippie times, when I was a dropout and I left everything behind, I left my family, I left my school, I left the dreams of my parents behind because they wanted me to be an engineer.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I went. I was fascinated by a different spirituality, like the hippies were. So I became a little bit of everything. So I was a Buddhist, then I was a Hare Krishna, then I was
right.
I was a little bit of everything. So the day that I realized that what is in my blood is Christianity. So, and Christianity, like any other religion, leads to the same light, and the same light that every single religion on this planet leads, that it is to make you a better person and committed to the state of the world, to your neighbor. And then, of course, I returned to Christianity after the pilgrimage to Santiago de Compostela.
So Christianity was your mother tongue, your homeland. Isn't that interesting that... That you reached home, in a way. You came back home because of this pilgrimage. And I want to talk to you about you discovering the experience of pilgrimage, the meaning of pilgrimage as a modern person. And then you've introduced it to so many other modern people. You walked the road of Santiago de Compostela, 500 miles. Had you even known about that pilgrimage? I mean, it's a very old, kind of the classic iconic pilgrimage. But was that something you also just discovered existed in the world?
Yeah, I did not know about this pilgrimage till the day that I was, so to say, invited to do this pilgrimage by a person that I call my master. But in fact, he's more like a friend to me. So I discovered this in 86. In 1986, I went to Spain, but I was not very convinced. I said, this is totally stupid to do a pilgrimage nowadays. You don't need to go back in time, to reach your soul. But sometimes some rites of passage are very, very much important. So I did not know that by then. So I did the pilgrimage. At the very beginning, I was longing for the thing to end. So the first 3 days,
right.
I said, my God, I still have 455 miles ahead of me. And I said, this is not going to end. This is totally stupid. What am I doing here? Mm-hmm. We live in a modern world. Till the fourth day. And the fourth day, I start getting used to the idea of walking and talking to people and be aware of my surroundings and learning about my body, but also start learning about my soul. So when I arrived in Santiago de Compostela, it was like a sad moment, because it was the end of something that was a turning point in my life, and I did not know what to do from that moment on.
A sad moment. I mean, that's the experience. That's how you felt at that moment. Is that what you
mean?
Yeah,
I thought, oh, my God, the day that I'm going to arrive in Santiago de Compostela, that means also that I fulfilled a task, and I can go back home. And right before Santiago, before you can see the city, there is a hill, and they call it Mons Gaudi in Latin. That means the Mount of Joy, meaning the pilgrims, they used to go there and for the first time see the towers of the cathedral and be full of joy. And when I arrived in Mons Gaudi, in the Mount of Joy, I felt the sadness because somehow something so different that I experienced in my life was going to end. But what I did not know by then, that it was that the real pilgrimage was about to start, because I did a physical pilgrimage. When I arrived in Santiago de Compostela, I understood finally that I had to make a choice in my life. And the choice would be, I have to fulfill my dream or I have to forget my dream forever. My dream was to be a writer. I was 40 years old, probably too old to change my path. But I said, no, I'm going to change. I'm going to leave everything behind. I'm going to burn my bridges. I'm going to follow my heart from now on, even if I have a price to pay. Mm-hmm. Of course, I was supported by my family, my wife. She said, yes, let's do it, even if everybody tells us that nobody can make a living out of writing, but let's take this risk, because otherwise you can have everything, but you'll be unhappy. And so I started by writing my first book, that it is The Pilgrimage. I may add something. When I did this pilgrimage in 1986, there were practically no pilgrims. The road was totally unknown.
I learned that in your writing, that this wasn't. Now it's something that many people do, but you're saying it wasn't at that time.
No, it was totally unknown. I never heard about this road. No? But, and I'm glad that somehow my book, my first book, The Pilgrimage, that I thought nobody's going to read, because who cares about this strange road to Santiago? But in fact, people read and people undertook this pilgrimage. So I was an instrument for this road, as this road was an instrument for me for changing my life for better.
And it seems to me that really just a core theme that runs through all your writing is life itself as a pilgrimage, writing as a pilgrimage for you, but also there's this effect of your work that is about reading as a pilgrimage or a way in, as a step on a path to pilgrimage for modern people. So interesting.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I also do believe that we have this possibility of doing a pilgrimage every single day, because a pilgrimage implies in meeting different people, in talking to strangers, in paying attention to the omens, and basically in being open to life. And we leave our home to go to work, to go to school, and we have every single day this possibility, this chance of discovering something new. So the pilgrimage is not for the privileged one who can go to Spain and to France and walk these 500 miles, but to people who are open to life. A pilgrimage at the end of the day is basically get rid of things that you are used and try something new.
It's lovely. And, you know, I have to say that there's a real, there's a restlessness about that, right? That there's a restlessness to you, a life-giving restlessness. You talk in one place about the difference between being a builder or a planter, and that a planter, a gardener, is never released from the demands of the garden. And you wrote, and it's by its constant demands it makes of the gardener's life a great adventure. But do you know what I mean? What you're not describing a life of settling or of peacefulness in a way. Maybe peacefulness in moments, no?
No, I think that this would be in contradiction with the nature, because nature is never in peace. You see the winter fighting.
It never stops,
against the summer. You see the sun exploding above my head now, you know. So confrontation is part of life. Sometimes I'm a little bit uncomfortable with this idea that let's give peace a chance. Of course, when you talk about...
From your hippie days,
When you talk about war, this is clear. War is a negative thing. But when you talk about yourself, you have to accept your contradictions, and you have to learn how to live with your contradictions. Otherwise, you become a block of stone that never changes. That's why being a gardener, in the metaphoric sense, is much more important than be a builder building things that they are not going to change. They can change, but the only change is decay. It's not something that you can improve.
Yes. So, you know, something that has intrigued me in my life of conversation, and I think it seems like a paradox that that when someone is able to be most articulate, most particular, articulate about their life, that in those moments, what they say can be most universally heard and felt. And it seems to me that this paradox is very central to your life of writing and even your, you know, your success as a writer, the reach of your writing. You've said that the question, the driving question behind all of your writing is, who am I? Who is Paulo Coelho?
Yes, which is a very tricky question. Right?
Yeah, but it's because so interesting that in as you pursue that question, that single-minded question, you know, as you say, the more you understand yourself, the more you will understand the world. Why? How do you explain that paradox?
I'm going to divide this question in two. The first one is, I saw you talking about tolerance and compassion.
Yeah.
So, which is very important.
I saw you
saying that sometimes compassion is understood like being weak and being unable to react. So every morning I find myself a different person. I'm always a mystery to myself. If I knew in the first hours of the morning what I'm going to do, what is going to happen, what attitude or decision should I take, I think my life would be deadly boring because what makes life interesting is the unknown. It is the risks that we take every single moment of our day, of a single day. So I think that this contradiction should be accepted. Mm-hmm. Having said that, I mean that learning how to live with our contradictions does not keep us away from being ethic and respecting our neighbor and learning about tolerance and learning about compassion. These are two very important very important words today that were totally forgotten.
Yeah.
So compassion and tolerance, we should emphasize the importance of these two words, but at the same time understand that the universe is confrontation. If you have tolerance and compassion, you can go to the battle in the metaphoric sense, of course, fighting for your dreams without harming anyone.
Right. So you experience and in some way embody this reality that as we wrestle with our contradictions and the hard things that life brings to each of us, we also that those are breeding grounds of compassion towards others. That wrestling, in fact, becomes a breeding ground for compassion. Is that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
At least for me.
Yeah.
At least for me, yes. The answer is yes.
Yeah. You know, I want to ask you about the word magic. And, you know, obviously your book that's been read by so many millions of people, The Alchemist, you know, The Alchemist, Alchemy. And you've written that your original pilgrimage, was set in motion when you were participating in a small Catholic order that included some work with benign magic. You know, you've talked about magic moments in life. Talk to me about what that word, that experience means for you. How can we understand that? It's not a very modern word, is it?
No, it is not. And sometimes very easily misunderstood. But if I can define magic, I would say that it is a bridge that allows us to cross from this visible world with this invisible world to this invisible world. So I'm talking to you and you can hear my voice, but behind my voice there are emotions. You can't see my emotions. You can grasp or have some sensations, but emotions are something that we can't see, we can't touch, we can't organize, but at the same time, emotions change the world. And the most important one being love. So as the Beatles said, all you need is love. I think that this summarizes very well what this world needs now.
Yeah.
If you can make love being not understood, but felt by people, accepted by people, probably, I'm saying probably, we will forget to ask questions like the one that you mentioned. Who am I? And instead of asking questions and trying to get answers, you will understand that you are a manifestation of love. And a manifestation of love cannot be understood. It can be felt.
Right.
And from the moment that you feel sure about this, you don't feel insecure of being a manifestation of love, you are going to understand that other people are going to respect. They are not going to cheat you. They are not going to try to take advantage of it because they also need love. I'm not trying to be an airy fairy guru because I'm not, I'm someone in the process of learning also. But one thing that I understood is that from the moment that I was not scared of manifesting my love, my life changed for better. I had my difficult moments, yes. I was hurt, yes. I was sad, yes. But still, this love that is what Jesus says about the love that goes beyond the fact that I like or dislike something, this love, that it is more powerful than anything else that the Greek used to a different word, because eros is for just love between a man and a woman, but right. the Greek used for just love that goes beyond like or just like, they have agape. Yeah. So I'm talking about agape, the love that consumes, the love that is us and our manifestation.
And agape is also more practical care, right? It's not just emotion. It's action.
Absolutely. You spotted it. Yeah, that's the right thing to say. You know, agape is action.
Yeah.
It's not about thinking. It's not about sit down. There are moments of ecstasy, that you sit down and you feel everything. And normally you cry. I cry. You know, at these moments, I have this urge of crying. But not crying for joy, not crying for sadness, no reason for crying of being amazed for being alive. And let us allow this thing to happen to us, you know, accepting and respecting the mystery. We don't need explanations for everything. Hmm. We need to fill our lives with love. And as love does not have explanations, okay, let's simply enjoy.
You know, you saw that talk I gave about how we've watered down the word compassion. And I think a lot about how, oh, even more so, 1,000,000,000 times more, we've watered down the word love, in certainly in the English language. And so, yes, you know, you say, the Beatles said, all you need is love. And when you say it, I think anyone listening, almost anyone listening, just knows intuitively that it's true. But it's also, it is one of these contradictions of being human, because that simple statement is true. And yet in many ways, you know, for most of us, learning to love is the longest pilgrimage of all in life. And it's even something that many people don't achieve or can't achieve.
Absolutely. And I don't know, why do you use this word cheese? You're too cheesy. Do you have anything about cheese? When you say, oh, he's being so cheesy when you manifest something that it is a true, the most important thing of that we have, we become very cynical. Mm-hmm. Probably disease defensive, you know?
Yeah.
A natural defensive attitude, because you want to love, you want to share your love, you want to show your love, but you don't want to be cheesy. So you destroy everything. Mm. Why do you use this word cheesy, Krista?
I don't know.
You don't know?
Well, I said achieve, but you're right. That's the word you want that is used to be dismissive. I mean,
absolutely.
You've also, I love the way you talk about virtues, and you know, you talked about agape, but there's also philia. There's the Greek calling out the love of friendship, and I think you that's also something that's important to you. This other nuance of love.
Yes, of course. Eros is very important to me.
Yes, yes.
I've been married for 34 years with the same woman, but is she the same woman? I don't think so.
Right.
I think that she changed a lot during this 34 years. And when people ask me, how did you manage to get married with the same woman for so long? I answer that they are wrong. She's not the girl that I met back in 1979. She changed a lot. So did I. You can imagine in 1982, I was dreaming about being a writer in 1979, And I was a person who was totally frustrated, and she had her dreams. And throughout all these years, our marriage went through many moments of destruction, so to say, but not destruction in a bad way. For example, it's like you build a house, and then you say, this house does not fit me anymore. So let's reorganize, but let's continue to live here. We don't need to move because I love you and you love me. So let's reconstruct this house. So we've been through many ordeals, many ordeals, but we survived. Why? Because of this word that you call a cheesy word, love. You know? I'm going to tease with this cheesy thing because I'm talking to you.
I won't be able to stop thinking about this.
I'm talking to you from Switzerland, and here cheese is something that is considered one of the most important things, you know, the main exportation product. So I'm going to defend the cheese itself, not as a derogative word, but something that it is positive.
Yeah. So I want to ask you about another just really central theme of your writing, certainly that's there in The Alchemist, that has inspired so many people, you know, the notion of the personal legend. And when I was getting ready to interview you, I saw Will Smith, who's this, you know, huge American movie star and cultural figure, talking about how he had been completely galvanized by reading The Alchemist. And he said, you know, this is what he said he took away, and it's an absolute paraphrase of what, you know, the things you say. That he learned from you that there's a redemptive power to make a choice, and rather than feeling like you are an effect of the things that have happened to you. And he said, I believe I can create whatever I want to create.
I saw his interview. Yeah. I saw Pharrell Williams' interview. And I'm going to use your program, Krista, to thank America, because America has been so generous with my work. My book is, at the moment of this interview, in the New York Times bestseller list for The Alchemist. You know?
Yeah.
For 310 weeks. I hope to remain there for well, many weeks more. But then Will Smith, Pharrell Williams, Julia Roberts, Madonna, Bill Clinton. Oh, well,
yes, Bill
there
Clinton,
is a list.
Yes.
There is a list. But you know what? Let me tell you something. When The Alchemist was published in America, well, of course, a foreign author, who is this guy with such a difficult name to pronounce, Coelho?
Right.
L-H-O, you know, is so complicated. So I thought, my God, I should have a different name, a pen name, because I'm planning to be translated in many places. But then nothing happened with the book. So we took 3 years or 4 years to sell the first, 10,000 copies. And then one day I was in Portugal and I saw Bill Clinton with the book. And I said, my God, the president of the United States of America has my book in his hand. And then I said, now the book is going to happen. No. Nothing happened. And then I saw Madonna in Vanity Fair saying, oh, you should read The Alchemist. And I said, oh, now it's my moment in America. Zero, nothing, you know. And then, of course, the support of many people. But I could not understand why so many people were talking about The Alchemist, and nothing was happening. Till the day, out of the blue, I saw the book for the first week in the New York Times bestselling list. But it took 15 years
really?
To arrive there.
I did not realize that.
Okay, in 1991, 2001. Yeah, it took 15 years.
Wow.
And then, I had the chance to meet Bill Clinton while he was still the American president. So we were in Davos, that it is the World Economic Forum, and I got this express invitation to meet the president of the United States. And then in Davos, you have this badge that tells you who you are. So in my badge was written writer. So I went to this small room with 30 people, and these 30 people, they have badges also. So they come to me and they said, oh, this must be a very important person because he's here. So they looked to my badge and they read author, and they immediately walked away. You know, so I was there in the corner with nobody paying attention to me.
You weren't a CEO.
I was not a CEO. I was not a congressman. I was not anybody important. And then Bill Clinton arrives. And the first thing he asks is, who is Paulo Coelho? I said, it's me, sir. I was in the corner alone, looking to the window outside, freezing snow, you know, and say, what am I doing here? It's, I loved your book, The Alchemist. And I said, but Mr. President, why did you read it? And he said, my daughter forced me to read, not only to read it, but to take a photo of the book, to promote the book. Well, it was very interesting because, you know, this is the true power of word of mouth.
Yeah.
It can reach your concierge, but it can reach the president of the United States and everybody else. So when my book went for the first time to the New York Times bestseller list, even after so many celebrities talking about it, I would like to take this opportunity to thank my readers in America, because thanks to them, I am where I am. And since then, all my books make the bestseller list.
You know, I guess the puzzle or that arises that I want to ask you about is, you know, somebody like Bill Clinton or Will Smith or Madonna, you know, they absolutely, in a very large way, embody this idea that we all create our own lives. And also this idea that's in your so much, again, in one of these central ideas, that the universe is conspiring in our favor, even though we may not understand how. But in many lives, in many situations, it's very hard to make that argument. Right? And so how do you reconcile that? How do you think about that?
Okay. Let me use myself as an example, right?
Yeah.
So I am a Brazilian. I write in Portuguese. And when I was young, and I said to my parents, I want to be a writer. My parents said, no way. And they put me 3 times in a mental institution because they are trying to control me. They said that I was crazy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Then you fast forward to the moment right after The Pilgrimage that I wrote The Pilgrimage, and then I wrote The Alchemist. And The Alchemist was published, and it did not sell at all in Brazil. So at the end of the first year, it sold 900 copies, if I'm not wrong. The first week was very exciting because, someone in the northeastern part of Brazil bought The Alchemist.
Right, yeah.
And then six months later, there was a second Alchemist sold in the northern eastern part of Brazil, and it was bought by the same person who bought the first one. And my My mother used to say, oh, you have a lot of friends and supporting you. I said, no, I don't know these people, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, but my publisher gave the book back to me and said, I don't want to publish this book anymore. Mm. But Krista was so convinced because at this moment, I had no choice. Either I move forward or I die. I die, not physically, probably, but spiritually I would die. So this sentence that you have in The Alchemist, that when you want something, the whole universe conspires to help you, I said, I have to honor my words. Hmm. I have to be an example. I have to give an example. Did I write this? I did. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to knock doors,
yeah,
trying to find a second publisher. I can't just sit down and say, okay, I lost the battle. It is impossible to be a writer. So I start knocking doors. And so the circumstances, as you put in your questions, were not favorable.
Yeah.
I was there being tested by life itself. So I knocked the door opened, and the book had a second chance. Take in mind, take into consideration that it was not a manuscript that could be successful. It was a book that was already published and was not successful at all.
Yeah.
But I was so convinced. And I had to prove to myself that I was not writing something that I don't believe, that knocking doors made all the difference.
So, you know, I'd love to read some beautiful lines that were in your acceptance speech when you entered the Brazilian Academy of Letters. You wrote, "The glory of the world is transitory, and we should not measure our lives by it, but by the choice we make to follow our personal legend, to believe in our utopias, and to fight for our dreams." And then you wrote, "We are all protagonists of our own lives, and it is often the anonymous heroes who make the deepest mark." It's very beautiful.
Thank you. Thank you. And it is true, because now I realize that I did not answer your question about personal legend. A personal legend that it is in the book, The Alchemist, is your dream. Something that you want to do, that gives you joy, that you love, back to love again, but also pleasure and joy. So you want to be a gardener, for example, and then you go to your parents, and your parents say, oh, gardener, first go to the university, get a diploma, then you can take care of your garden in your spare times. Or you want to be a writer, or you want to be an explorer, or you want to be whatever. You know,
whatever, you just want to be a parent, right? I mean, there's so many dreams that are not, you know, being a movie star, but that are so essential and life-giving. I think you're saying that, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, so you want to do something that it is against the plans that other people have for you.
Right.
So there you face this very hard choice. Either you start living the dreams of someone else, meaning your parents, your wife, your husband, or paying the price of your dream. So this is the most hard choice that you have in life. At the very beginning of your life, when you are a teenager, you know what you want. Then you forget for a while. It happened to me. And then you have another chance, a second chance. Life is very generous. Hmm. It always gives you a second chance. And then it's up to you to grab this opportunity or to forget it forever. I mean, you can't forget it forever, Krista, because there is always this inner child within yourself saying, hey, I'm here. I had a dream to be something else, and now you are making money, you have a house here, you have a penthouse there, you have whatever, but you are not doing what you were intended to do. You are not fulfilling your personal legend. That's why you see so many people rich, famous, and then they go through this very self-destructive path.
Right.
Because they are doing something that they are making a lot of money, but they are not happy.
Yeah.
So, and they are not fulfilling their dreams.
And what about people whose struggle is not that they're rich and famous, but that they are impoverished and, you know, beaten down and anonymous?
Well, first of all, I give you myself as an example, because today everybody says, oh, you are Paulo Coelho, so it's easy to say things that the whole universe conspires. But no, it is always difficult. The second thing is that money or poverty, as you call it, is not that important. I could never dream of making money out of writing. What is important is to have joy. I come from a country that's not very rich.
Yeah.
It's not very poor either. Yeah. But I see in the eyes of the people something that I seldom see in the so-called developed countries. I see joy. Hmm. Joy of life. The French, they have this beautiful expression, joie de vivre.
So,
joy of being alive. You know? So let's not use poverty or richness as a pattern to judge. Hmm. If you want to do something, the universe is going to conspire. Look and read the, you know better than I, because we know that we have a lot of excuses to not fulfill our personal legend, to not fulfill your dream.
Yeah.
We say, oh, I don't have money, oh, I'm going to postpone, oh, which I did, by the way. I'm not criticizing anybody because I did that.
Right.
And then the day come and you have the worst excuse of all. You said, I'm not going to do this for the sake of my children or my husband or whatever. Then you use love as an excuse for not doing something that it is very important to you. And that it is very important for your beloved ones. You don't ask them. You just take for granted that if you take the risks of fulfilling a dream, they are going to starve to death. It's not true.
Mm-hmm.
They will be very happy to see you happy. So, because they love you. They love you. So, Krista, I do believe that we have no excuses for not fulfilling our personal legend.
Okay.
We can be poor. We can, and the story is full of examples. No?
Yeah. Yes,
we
yes,
can
yes,
be poor.
Yes.
We can be born in a different country, whatever. But if we persevere, and this is what the Jesuits taught me, and it was very important, perseverance. And if you go to I Ching, this Chinese book, it says, perseverance brings good luck. So we should stop excusing ourselves for not fulfilling our personal legend and move ahead.
I want to ask you about elegance, something you talk about as a virtue. We've talked, you know, we talked about the virtue of love and friendship and boldness, but very drawn to your use of the word elegance. Talk to me about the place of elegance in life's pilgrimage.
Elegance is simplicity.
Mm. Mm.
I believe that we need to be elegant because people confound elegance with fashion.
Yeah.
And it has nothing to do. I learned about elegance not because I was reading about fashion, blah, 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 because one day I was in Japan and I saw just totally empty house. I don't know. You've been to Japan?
I have not. Not yet.
Okay. So anyway, they have these empty places, and then they have a small detail, like a flower arrangement or a painting, yeah. And the rest is empty. And I said, oh, my God, what is this? This guy, it was my publisher, no? Yeah. Who had a Rodin, a statue of a very famous French sculptor in his garden. He had this empty place. And I said, because for us, richness is also associated with toys and toys and toys and toys. But yeah, he had this empty place and a beautiful flower arrangement that they call it origami. So I said, what is this? And he said, I will never forget. He said, this is elegance. I said, elegance? He said, yes, because here there is only one detail that you can pay attention. Because of this, elegance is to get rid of all the superfluous things and focus in the most beautiful one. In this case, it was this flower arrangement. So for me, when I look to the mountains, to the Alps here in Switzerland, and I see this white snow, and I said, oh my God, God could have created snow as a rainbow, you know, full of colors. But then this would be a disaster, you know, because the beauty of the snow is because it has only one color. Mm. The beauty of the desert, that I love desert, by the way. Yeah. I spent 40 days in the Mojave Desert back in 1989. And it was so magical. So every time that I travel, I visit the desert. But then back to elegance. Elegance is to go to the core of beauty. Mm. And the core of beauty is simplicity.
Lovely. Oh, this is such a beautiful, nourishing conversation. I'm so grateful for your time. I just want to ask you just two more questions. You've said that that one way you have of meditating is archery, bows and arrows.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
So I'm not, Krista, this person who sits in a lotus position. I did that a lot. Huh? Mm-hmm. But, and say, I can't do this. You know, I'm much more like a warrior than like a wise man. Mm. So I thought, my God, it's so difficult for me to meditate sitting and try not to think. It is against nature for me, my nature, because I'm more like a warrior of the light. So one day I learned about archery, not the archery, the normal archery, but a kind of meditation called Kyudo, also Japanese art.
Yeah.
That you only have eight movements. Huh? In yoga, I don't know how many movements you have, but in Kyudo, you have eight movements that I'm not going to describe because it's simple, but anyway, you have to watch it. So at the end, you open your arm and you have this tension, 43 pounds. You know, it's like you have a luggage of 43 pounds in horizontal. You know? And then you release the string and the arrow goes and immediately you are in a state of total relax. So this contrast between total tension and total relaxing, you can see the universe through your bow. Mm. So from the moment that I learned archery, I decided this is my way to meditate. And I really encourage people at least to try, because it is beautiful, it is elegant, and it helps you to meditate.
You know, it also, the way you describe that also reminds me of something you said that I loved when we first began to speak about the process of pilgrimage, that it was in discovering your body that you discovered your soul.
The same thing happens with archery. You're right, Krista.
Yeah.
So the same thing, because you see the tension in your body, and then you see this tension disappearing, and you are in this state of grace and communion. Mm. You are totally right. Mm. Yes. Mm.
This question that we talked about is the driving question behind your writing. Who am I? The human question, you know, it's your version of the question of what does it mean to be human. I'm curious about how, if you had to think about it, how your understanding, your sense of that, what it means to be human, has evolved across all these experiences of your lifetime and your lifetime of writing.
Okay, Krista, so you said you had two more questions. This is the final question. I have to give an intelligent answer. So, to be totally honest, I don't know who I am. And I don't think people ever will know who they are. We have to be humble enough to learn to live with this mysterious question. Who am I? So I am a mystery to myself. I am someone who is in this pilgrimage from the moment that I was born to the day that will come that I'm going to die. And this is something that I can't avoid, whether I like it or not, or I'm going to die. So what I have to do is to honor this pilgrimage through life. And so I am this pilgrim, if I can somehow answer your question, who is constantly amazed by this journey, who is learning a new thing every single day, but who is not accumulating knowledge, because then it becomes a very heavy burden in your back. I am this person who is proud to be a pilgrim and who is trying to honor his journey.
Paulo Coelho, thank you so much. Thank you so much for spending this time with me, and I can't wait to share your voice with my listeners.
Thank you very much, Krista. And if I go to U.S., where are you based, Krista?
We are in Minnesota. And we would be thrilled to welcome you. We have a beautiful studio here. And if you came to Minnesota, we could gather some people. We would have a dinner for you. I would love to welcome you here.
I read that you're in Minnesota. So next time, probably by the end of the year, I'm planning to go to U.S. Yeah. Not to promote books, but to enjoy U.S.
Absolutely. No? Please come here.
And if you ever come to Geneva, I would love to meet you.
Yeah, all right. So listen, my producer, Lily, across the glass, do you have a minute for another question?
Of course,
She wants to, so, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you hear those questions?
No.
Okay.
Lily, there is a match between Switzerland and Argentina, and then there is USA also play to light.
Well,
don't be naughty.
You know, I have to say, Lily's Colombian. Lily's Colombian, so she's very engaged.
Yeah. So Colombia is going to play Brazil in 2 days from now. Yeah. I hope Colombia wins.
She's completely involved. Let me just this question would be, I'd love to have this. Did your parents ever accept you as a writer? Did they honor that?
My parents did not accept me as a writer. Mm. On the opposite. They were desperate. My parent was an engineer. And then he had his dreams for me, which I did not decided to fulfill. So he thought first to convince me, then to blackmail me, and finally when he saw that nothing was working, he put me on a mental institution because he thought I was crazy. He did this out of love, not out of trying to harm me or to cause me any harm. So I had, but this is a very important thing in everybody's life, is this sacred frame of rebellion. When you're young, you learn how to defend your values.
Yeah, right. I have a 16-year-old son who I'm experiencing that right now. So interesting. It's fascinating. I mean, it's
tough. Well, so he can react.
Hit you back. Yeah. Okay, but did your parents live to see the success of The Alchemist, or did they experience that?
My parents did live to see the success in Brazil, that it was gigantic, and then abroad also. But I don't think they realized, even for me it's very difficult to realize. I go to the street and then someone come to me and say, oh, you're Paulo Coelho and blah, blah. And I feel very honored, but I don't realize it's impossible because I sold 175 million copies. That means all books considered, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That means close to 500 million readers. So it is an abstraction.
Yeah,
you can think about five people in your having dinner with you, and you think it's too crowded. But when you go to 500 million people, it becomes an abstraction.
Yeah. Well, again, it's been such a pleasure, and I do hope we meet, and I'd like to try to make that happen one of these days. And we'll let you know. I think we're going to put this on the air this summer, and we'll give you lots of advance notice. And I'm just very grateful to have had this conversation. So thank you. Thanks for what you do. Thank you very much,
Krista.
Yeah. All right. Bye-bye.
It was a pleasure for me.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Good luck to U.S. tonight.
Thank you.
Ciao.
Lily's listening.
Bye.
Okay. Yeah, bye-bye.